This public radio podcast is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. We're all getting used to the lack of privacy in this day and age. I mean, websites track us with cookies, grocery stores track us through loyalty cards, and apparently, even the state of our physical well-being is no longer off limits.
Somebody dreamed this up as a legal way to exploit health records for profit.
And you don't really have a choice in the matter. Meanwhile, there are lots of things you just don't want to talk about over, say, beers and peanuts. But why not personal finance?
It's difficult to talk to your friends about it when they don't really care, so I thought, oh, I'd go online. I saw these other blogs, and I said, hey, I could do this.
And if he can do it, so can I. Oh, and who are these people?
They book crowded flights on Friday evenings, knowing that the airline's likely to start asking for volunteers.
We promise your seat is guaranteed on this hour of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Funny how we can't seem to shake report cards. There's the class report card that determined whether we graduated. There's the credit report card that determines our interest rates. And now, a health report card that determines whether we qualify for insurance. I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
If you've never heard of a health credit report, don't worry. We hadn't either until this week. But for the past few years, insurers have been able to legally gain access to millions of our electronic prescription drug records. And they're using those files to determine whether or not to grant you a health or life insurance policy. Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
Imagine corporations that could peer inside every American's medicine cabinet electronically. Taking Viagra, Ambien, an antidepressant, all that information is just a click away, and these companies already exist.
MedPoint shows each prescription, the date it was filled, number of refills, and includes a link to information for the prescribing physician.
MedPoint and another company called Milliman IntelliScript have built powerful data mining systems that tap into and search billions of pharmacy records about more than 200 million Americans. They perform these searches for insurance company underwriters. Richard Dick invented this technology almost a decade ago.
When you apply for insurance, you sign an authorization to go and get all of your medical records, any and all of them.
Looking at the medicines you take helps them decide how much to charge for life or health insurance, or whether to write you a policy at all. So if you are on high blood pressure medicine, that's evidence of a pre-existing condition. Coverage denied. Richard Dick realized that most of the information insurance companies wanted was already collected electronically by pharmacies. He tapped into those pharmacy databases and then started selling insurance companies access to these electronic records.
Somebody dreamed this up as a legal way to exploit health records for profit.
Robert Gelman's a privacy consultant. He says these electronic searches save insurance companies money. They might help make health and life insurance cheaper and could even be used to improve health care, but there are enormous privacy concerns. An investigation by the FTC earlier this year found that MedPoint and IntelliScript violated federal law by effectively keeping the system under wraps for years. Until recently, it's likely you'd never know if an insurer used your electronic pharmacy records to deny you coverage. Andy Slavitt is the CEO of MedPoint's parent company.
I think all of the regulations have yet to be written and fully thought through.
The one thing you can't do is remove yourself from the database entirely. And Dr. Kate Atkinson, a family practitioner in Amherst, Massachusetts, is worried. Over time, that could have profound public health consequences.
I think this is the type of thing that's going to ultimately keep people from getting medical care. Once patients begin to figure out that if they take a certain drug, they won't be able to get insurance, more and more they'll refuse to take a certain drug.
In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriveand.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com.
It's been a little over a year since the phrase subprime crisis entered our collective conscience. The mortgage meltdown has been explained mostly by subprime borrowers getting loans they could not afford. But they're not the only ones who did. As the New York Times pointed out this week, a good chunk of homeowners with good credit took a similar road using adjustable rate and interest-only mortgages. We heard from one of them this week. Douglas Kim is a homeowner in Steamwood, Illinois. Welcome to the program.
Sure. Nice to be here.
When you purchased your home, could you have gotten a traditional 30-year fixed mortgage?
I actually started out with a 30-year traditional mortgage, and the rate was quite high compared to what I thought I would get.
And that's when you refinanced into an interest-only loan?
Yes.
What drew you to that option?
The mortgage broker was one of my friends. I actually told him that my first priority was to pay off high-interest credit card. So I asked him to set up a mortgage that required the minimum amount of payment per month.
And how long was the loan designated interest-only?
Actually, I am not sure about that because I was kind of ignorant at the time and I wasn't really well educated as I am now, but I'm thinking it's 5 years.
So when would you have to start paying principal?
About 2 years.
Will you be able to afford the payments if you are not able to refinance before you have to start paying principal?
Well, I am hoping that the housing market will get better and my house value will go up to the level where it was, but I am not in a position where I have to foreclose or anything. So I'm not too worried about that, but I just don't like suffering for someone else's problems.
That was Douglas Kim from Steamwood, Illinois. And there he says he's suffering for someone else's problems. But is that really the case? Why would borrowers with good credit get themselves into risky loans? Jeremy Brandt is with a real estate investment company. And let me ask you first, what's the difference, if any, when we talk about a default on a prime mortgage versus a subprime one?
Well, the end result of their situation is really not very different. Both segments of people are typically ending in foreclosure. A subprime borrower may be headed to foreclosure much quicker. Typically, their interest rate is much higher than a prime borrower's are. And so when they head to foreclosure, their interest rate is adjusting upwards and adjusts upward at a much higher level and much quicker.
Given that a prime borrower is supposedly very creditworthy, very responsible with their money, why would someone choose an adjustable rate mortgage or an interest-only loan if they could afford a traditional loan?
That's a great question. And really, a couple of the differences are in some markets, they couldn't afford a traditional loan, especially on the coast where we see some of the biggest fallout from some of the creative lending practices. In some markets, you needed a $1 million loan just to get into a basic property in some of these major cities on the coast.
Yeah, like here in Southern California.
Well, absolutely. Southern California is kind of the poster child for some of the loan problems that we've had. And as you know, in a lot of markets of Southern California, you just can't buy a house for $200,000 or $300,000. So a lot of people that were renting and had great credit wanted to buy a house and had a growing family and were talked into one of these very creative loans that allowed them to purchase a property that was maybe still beyond their means.
Why are we seeing this wave of prime borrower foreclosures and trouble with mortgages now instead of at the same time as we saw them with subprime?
Well, the subprime was really on the front end of some of the mortgage problems. So most people that got a subprime loan, the terms of the loan weren't quite so good. So they were really the first ones to fall victim to rising interest rates. Prime borrowers typically had a much lower interest rate, even though it was still interest only, and could maybe survive one or two resets before they couldn't afford the payments on their house anymore.
So what if this wave of prime borrowers can't refinance? What happens then?
What's happening to the prime borrowers that we see that are getting behind in payments is They're working out repayment plans with their lender. So in between foreclosure and refinancing your loan, a lot of homeowners have the opportunity to call their lender directly and try to renegotiate the terms of their loan. And that's really only applicable if the homeowner is behind in payments and is kind of foreclosure is imminent. Banks do not want to foreclose on homeowners, and so they have the opportunity to work things out with them and keep them in the house.
Jeremy Brandt, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Brandt is with the company 1-800-CASH-OFFER. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, you know, I was just talking to Jeremy about how all these homeowners with prime mortgages, not subprime, not Alt-A, they all now owe more money than their home is worth. What's your take on what's going on here?
Well, what's going on is that a lot of people, even in the prime market, stretched to buy a home. I mean, they really pushed. And now, if we use real estate jargon, and I know how much you love real estate jargon, but
Jargon in general.
They're underwater. I mean, and that means they can't get out of trouble the old-fashioned way, which is refinancing, you know, borrowing against the equity in your home.
Yeah. Is this going to get worse? I mean, you know, we both saw that New York Times article earlier this week, and it seemed to indicate that this is the next big shoe.
Well, I think it will get worse. Part of it is a number of people are going to be hit hard when their mortgage rates reset. But I really agree with Dean Baker. He's an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And what he's been emphasizing is the main problem is the crash in housing prices. And until the housing market stabilizes, the situation for these prime borrowers will get worse.
What is the solution then? How do you bring home prices back when people are afraid to buy?
Well, I think there are two things that are going on. Part of it is the Fed and the Treasury are trying to prevent a meltdown of the financial system. And we keep getting these momentary reliefs. You remember Bear Stearns? Okay, we avoided a meltdown there. Oh, now it's Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Okay, we avoided a meltdown there. So clearly, the troubles in the banking system are continuing. Secondly, they are trying to stem this rising tide of foreclosures. But the main thing is waiting for young people, people who didn't buy, people who have decent credit ratings, to start going into the market and saying, there's some value here. It's always hard to predict the bottom of a market, but at some point, prices will get low enough to start attracting buyers, but we're not there yet.
I want to ask you about another development this week. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that this is now kind of affecting people who are not subprime borrowers. These are people with really good credit and sometimes people with a whole lot of money. And Morgan Stanley came out, of all places, this week and said it's freezing a bunch of home equity lines of credit. And these have got to be people with a lot of money. Why?
Well, it's because of, again, they're underwater. They're a riskier asset. And now they're getting frozen because the banks are saying, we don't want to take the risk.
So fair to say that this is all going to get worse before it gets better?
It is very fair to say that it's going to get worse before it gets better. But you're at the epicenter. The discussion among real estate professionals is watch California. California is the key. It's when the buying starts picking up in California that you'll be able to say the market is starting to turn around.
Well, we will watch out for that. Thanks so much, Chris, and we'll talk to you later in the show.
Thanks a lot.
You want to talk IRAs and your family wants you to go away.
It's difficult to talk to your friends about it when they don't really care. So I thought, I'd go online. I saw these other blogs and I said, hey, I could do this.
We go around the table with some personal finance bloggers. And speaking of tables, tennis anyone? A day in the work life of a pro paddle tennis player. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We'll be right back. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Vigeland. You'd think I'd get enough personal finance news working on this show, right? Wrong. I spend what is probably an inordinate amount of time reading personal finance blogs. And I've wondered, why did this person decide to open his or her financial life up to the world? So we decided to get a few of my favorite bloggers together and ask them. Lene is the founder of beingfrugal.net. Jim runs Blueprint for Financial Prosperity. And Steve's blog is called bripblep.com. So how'd you guys get started, Jim?
I got into personal finance blogging about 3 years ago. None of my friends were interested in the whole personal finance thing. You know, you're coming out of college and you now are making some money and none of that retirement and investing, that doesn't matter.
It's a long ways away, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to talk to your friends about it when they don't really care. So I thought, oh, I'd go online. I saw these other blogs and I said, hey, I could do this. So I started blogging about it and learning. It's been fun.
Okay. Lene, how about you?
I'm Lene, and I started my personal finance blog, beingfrugal.net, about a year ago. I didn't even know personal finance blogs existed. My husband and I are trying to pay off some debt and just live a frugal life. And so I started blogging, and, you know, the rest is history.
Okay. And Steve?
Well, I actually had been writing a political blog for several years and finally got frustrated with it and decided it wasn't really worth my time. At about that time, my wife and I had our first child, and I got much more interested in the subject and decided to switch my blog from being about politics to being about personal finance.
And I have to ask you, where did you get the title of your blog, Brip Blap?
Yeah, that's a fairly common question. There's a movie starring Jack Lemmon called How to Murder Your Wife, and in it, he apparently describes somebody who's having wild emotional mood swings as Brip Blap, and my parents thought that was a funny line, and I was apparently as a baby very frequently changing my moods. And so they called me the Brit Black Baby. And I've continued to use that name from time to time.
Well, tell me a little bit about kind of what you think your mission is as bloggers. Do you consider yourselves journalists? Are you financial experts? I guess what I'm asking is what qualifies you to be talking about finances in such a way where people are actually coming to you for advice? And Jim, I'll start with you again.
That's difficult to answer. Where I see myself is just someone who's just keeping a public journal online that others can read for either information or entertainment, because a lot of the things that I write revolve around the stories that happened to me. So for a while, I was writing a lot about buying a house. And so I would just write about that. And I think people would, you know, learn about my experiences and be entertained and somewhat educated by it. I don't really see myself as a personal finance expert.
Lene?
I see myself more as an encourager. I've been a stay-at-home mom. We've been a one-income family in a nation where two-income families are the norm. And I try to encourage my readers who are maybe struggling a little bit financially that you don't have to have a $100,000 income to survive in this world. And it's just kind of a place for people to go to get ideas on how we can save money when we need to.
And Steve?
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, I don't view myself as a journalist or a reporter, certainly, but I do share my own experiences and thereby inspire other people to think about their own experiences.
Jim, you're one of the many, many personal finance bloggers out there who, on your website, list things like credit card or balance transfer arbitrage. And this is where you get a credit card, borrow against it, put it into a savings account, and then, you know, before you're 0% balance time is up, you put it back in, and so therefore you've gained a lot of money on your savings interest rate. Do you ever have any concerns about people coming to your website and thinking that they can do this when they really shouldn't be?
I don't really get too concerned because, I mean, I outline, you know, all the risks that are involved in doing these moves, and even now I would tell someone not to do it because the savings rates of all these online banks is so low that Just the amount of effort that you need to put into it to get a return is way too much. I mean, it's risky from the sense that it deals with credit, but it's really an exercise in how diligent you are and how, I guess, exacting that you may be. If you follow up with everything, it's really not that much risk.
All right. I want to ask each of you, what's the best tip that you've got on your site right now? I'll start with you, Lene.
The best tip would be just to live within your means. Don't go into debt for things that don't appreciate in value. I think all of us have probably at one time or another made the mistake of getting into credit card debt, and it's hard to get out. And so just don't make that mistake in the first place.
Anything you regret putting on your website?
Not really. My life's an open book. You know, I've definitely put mistakes like taking out $10,000 in student loans that for a degree I never finished was a bad idea. But you know, if people learn from that, that's great. You know, I don't regret putting it up.
Yeah, yeah. Jim?
It's similar to Linnaeus. It's just spend within your means. You know, save up a good emergency fund because you never know when an emergency is going to strike.
All right. And Steve?
My best tip, actually, that I got a lot of feedback on was I said that after you have concentrated on cutting your spending, you should forget about that, maintain that, and start concentrating a lot on earning more.
And anything that you've posted that you thought, I shouldn't have done that?
Yeah, I wrote actually a series of posts all around the general theme of why having a stay-at-home spouse was infinitely superior to having two working spouses. As you can imagine, I got a lot of feedback.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to thank all three of you for doing a lot of research and for sharing your stories. Lene, your website again?
Beingfrugal.net.
Okay. And Steve?
Mine is BritBlap.com, and I'll spell it. It's BRIPBLAP.com.
All right. And Jim?
My website is PFBlueprint.com.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us.
Thanks, Tess.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Tess. It was fun.
We've got links to all three of their blogs on our website, marketplace.org. And starting this weekend, you can find another blog on our site, mine. Look for a link to Making Money, where each week I will take you through the sausage factory that is Marketplace Money. We do love our plastic. This week, the Federal Reserve reported that consumer debt rose by $14 billion in June. Uh-oh. Well, for today's summer school session, we're educating you on something called universal default. Here's personal finance expert Jonathan Clements to explain it.
Pretty much every credit card company will boost the interest rate it charges on your credit card balance if you're late paying your bill, if you charge more than your credit limit allows, or if the check you write to make your credit card payment bounces. All this is standard operating procedure. But lurking in your credit card agreement could be a potentially nasty surprise that's sometimes known as universal default. Your credit card company may have the right to boost the interest rate it charges if, say, you're late making payments on your mortgage or even on another credit card. You can also trigger a higher rate by going over the credit limit on one of your credit cards, by applying for too much credit, or any other event that dings your credit report. In other words, your credit card might charge you a higher rate because of something that happens on a totally different account. As a consumer, if you trigger one of these change of terms or universal default provisions and the credit card company starts sticking you with a higher rate, what can you do? You can phone up and complain, but that probably won't do you much good. The best thing you can do is get that credit card balance paid off as quickly as possible, or otherwise you might end up incurring interest rates that approach 30%. All this is a reminder that America's financial institutions are keeping a close eye on your credit report. So it's critical that you pay your bills on time and you strive mightily not to carry too much debt. You should probably also check your credit reports regularly. Once a year, you can get a free copy of your credit report from each of the three major credit bureaus by going to www.annualcreditreport.com. Think of it this way. Everyone else seems to be looking at your credit reports. Maybe you should, too.
Jonathan Clements is the Director of Financial Guidance for MyFi, an advisory service from Citigroup. And if you'd like some extra credit, go to marketplace.org and tell us your favorite financial term and define it. Might be you at the blackboard next week.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
All right, it's time for Getting Personal when we turn the microphone around to answer your questions. With me once again is our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go right to the phones. Our first caller is Robin, and she joins us from Marquette, Michigan. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
What can we help you with today?
Well, I had a question about stocks. My mom and dad invested some money in stocks for all their grandchildren. Now the kids are getting to the age where they're in college. And so my oldest daughter has just finished her freshman year, and she needs some money. So she has two different stocks that they've invested in. One is McDonald's and one is Intel. And so she'd like some accessible money, and I'm debating what to do.
Well, what do you think, Chris? Obviously, if they go ahead and cash out this stock, there are going to be some tax consequences later on. But is this a good idea?
Well, we're going to have to go with Chris Farrell's law, which is if I say sell them, they'll double in price over the next year. And if I say hold on to them, they'll fall by half.
I don't like that law.
No.
I think we need to repeal that law.
Absolutely. I have a couple of follow-up questions. If she doesn't sell the stock at all, will she be borrowing money to help meet these expenses?
No, probably not.
Okay. Then here's what I would do. Wouldn't turn it into an either or. I would probably sell a little bit of both. There will be capital gains tax, but since she's not earning much of an income, this is actually probably a good time from that point of view to be selling. A lot of people, if I were answering this question, it would be, look, sell the stock so you're not taking out student loans.
Right. So because I'm not someone that really follows the stock market either, just leave them. We'll kind of ride the tide or whatever and let them go.
Right. There is then a timing issue because with McDonald's, that stock has been performing better. You'll get a better price. Intel has been under a lot of competitive pressures recently. It hasn't been performing well. So, you know, I'd probably lean slightly towards selling a little bit of the stronger stock just so you get a better price. But again, you're not going to be selling that much. She's still going to have a pretty decent little nest egg there for when she graduates.
Right.
All right. Does that help you out, Robin?
It does.
Well, terrific. Thanks so much and best of luck to your daughter.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That is 877-ASK-MONEY. So, Chris, we heard from Gavin in Sunnyvale, California. He sent an email telling us that he's 29 years old. He just got his first job with access to a Roth 401k plan. But he's thinking about moving overseas in about a year or so. So he's wondering whether it would be better for him to go ahead and contribute to this Roth 401k or hang on to the money so he has a little bit of an emergency fund when he does go overseas. What do you think here?
Well, I'm going to have to answer this with a couple of questions that I'll toss out there. One of which is, you know, Tess, we talk about all the time, is there a match? And you would participate in the Roth 401k to the extent of the match, no matter what, and then put the rest aside for emergency purposes.
Because otherwise you're really just leaving compensation on the table at your employer, right?
Oh, you really are. Yeah. And that's where your real investment return comes from. The other thing is, a lot of times we turn these questions into an either or. Either I participate in the Roth or I save for emergency purposes. And there can be priorities, but time is one thing we can never bring back. So all of us with the best intentions, you know, we get lazy. So open up the Roth, even if you're not participating to the maximum, put at least some money into that 401k plan, no matter what.
There you go. There's your answer, Gavin. And Chris, I also wanted to bring in another email that we received last weekend after you and I were talking on the show about life cycle funds. These are target date funds. They go by a bunch of different names. Patricia wrote in from San Diego and said, I find lifestyle funds pure bunk. And the concern that she raises is that there's not a big, long track record on these life cycle funds. So how do we know that they're a good place to park our money? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, there's not a long-term track record in terms of the life cycle fund or the target date funds. But basically, if you look at what's being created, it's a diversified portfolio with low-cost index funds. So we have a fair amount of history that says this type of portfolio performs like this over a period of time. There's another more slightly cynical answer. In many cases, you know, someone would say, well, how much should I put in the stocks? How much should I put into equities? And they'd say, well, you know, you take your age and subtract it from 100, and that's how much you put into equities, and the remainder goes into bonds. And one way of looking at a lot of lifestyle funds and the target date funds is they are essentially doing that for you automatically, so you don't have to do it every year. Because what we've learned over a period of time is we can talk all about the need for rebalancing and taking a look at how your portfolio is performing and making sure that you're well diversified.
That doesn't mean everybody's going to actually do it.
They don't do it. So what a life cycle fund does, it does it for you automatically. For most people, they work well.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. And do stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Every 4 years, we all turn into couch potatoes to watch the best athletes on earth swim, run, jump, and hurl themselves to Summer Olympic gold. Oh, I forgot, ping pong themselves too. Table tennis is one of the most popular sports in China. But there's another form of tennis that hasn't netted an Olympic nod, at least not yet. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a different brand of paddle-wielding athlete.
Hello. Oh, good morning, my pigeon. How are you? You want to lose some money today? My name is Scott Friedman. I live in Venice Beach, California. I'm a professional paddle tennis player. How much are we playing for? Yeah, that sounds like a good amount. Bring the cash and we'll play. Money speaks. I've been the world champion now for about 21 out of 23 years of my career. Paddle tennis is a game that's played on a court that looks just like a tennis court, but it's about two-thirds the size, and then it's used with a wooden racket that is about half the size of a tennis racket with no strings. The game looks and plays exactly like tennis. You know, I mean, the biggest difference between paddle tennis and, say, racquetball or ping pong or, you know, big tennis, there are no big, you know, official sponsors. There's not a lot of TV coverage. They have tournaments all around the country, and you make prize money. And then there is a unique opportunity where I make most of my money, and that is gambling within paddle tennis. I'll play a guy on roller skates for $5,000. I will play with a frying pan. I'll do whatever I have to make the money. The truth of the matter is that, you know, we make, not we, you know, I, myself, and another guy who's a kind of a hustler, you know, really good player, you know, we make well in excess of $100,000 a year just in gambling paddle tennis. I am an incredibly, incredibly super blessed person to be able to do what it is I do, such as get up in the morning, have my coffee, kiss my wife, walk my dog, and then decide who I'm going to beat the crap out of this day. In paddle tennis, like in any other sport, such as tennis or basketball, there's so many different skills and you know, attributes that people have to have, speed, quickness. But I think what makes myself a very good paddle tennis player more than anything else is two things. Would be my desire to want to win, sort of don't kick them when they're down, but shoot them when they're down. And I know exactly where my opponent's at every moment of the match. I know exactly where they're at in their head. I know if they're nervous. And I would say my paddle tennis IQ. Can I win every single day? Probably, pretty close, but you have to lose a little bit because you got to keep your pigeons coming back, meaning that if you got a guy that's worth $1 million and he comes out to the beach to have a good time and, of course, to try to win money off you or take you off, there are certain days you actually have to lose. The most important thing is to keep these guys, these rich guys, coming, and you got to keep them coming with the cash because this is the way you make a living.
A Day in the Work Life came to us from Francesca Segre. For photos of Scott Friedman in action, check out our website, marketplace.org. Don't know about you, but I want to live like this guy.
I never feel sore muscles, never wiped out. My brain is never foggy.
Caffeine? Nope. Seaweed. We weigh the benefits and costs of going veggie. Up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Viglund. So, what are you? Vegetarian? Vegan? Flexitarian? Fruitarian? Pescatarian? Carnivore? Presbyterian? Who knew there were so many ways to categorize eating? You know, these days going veggie is like reading War and Peace. Even if you haven't, you feel compelled to say you did. Vegetarianism is the new black, or shall we say the new green. But as Cash Peters found out when he made the big switch, the animal-free life can get expensive.
Oh, guess what? I've become a vegetarian.
Yeah!
Calm down. I only just started. But I made the decision after I met this guy, Dave Wolf. He's a health guru, and therefore somebody I'd usually avoid.
I've been a raw food vegetarian for over 15 years now, and I never feel sore muscles, never wiped out. My brain is never foggy because there's nothing clogging my system.
Yeah, well, okay. Problem is, if I did turn vegetarian and quit hamburgers, chicken, sausages, or as I call them, my friends in the fridge, what was I going to eat instead? You know, realistically. Turned out it's exactly what I'd feared. Organic vegetables. I know, crazy people food, right?
You know, I could take an avocado, sprinkle a little bit of kelp on it, and have a little bit of seaweed, like dull seaweed, and I'm good to go.
Yeah, well, good for you. Avocado and seaweed. Ugh. Colleen Patrick-Goudreau is the woman behind vegetarian website CompassionateCooks.com.
I encourage people to cook from scratch as much as possible and eat whole foods. We're talking about fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and beans and herbs and spices. And it doesn't take that long to chop up some vegetables.
Well, no, but it takes longer than visiting the drive-thru at Wendy's. But you know what? I did it anyway. I switched to crazy people food. Started eating fruits and raw vegetables. Even bought a recipe book and made a vegetarian meatloaf using buckwheat instead of meat. Oh, sure, it tastes like the stuff they use as filler in padded envelopes, but it's healthy. Oddly, Colleen wasn't impressed.
I don't know why you're making a buckwheat loaf to begin with, but that's your choice.
It's vegetarian, that's why.
Yeah, just because it's vegetarian doesn't mean it's good. You have to learn some new recipes, and those will become part of your routine. Perhaps the buckwheat loaf isn't for you.
Oh, you think? But it's not just about the taste. Turning vegetarian can be expensive. My grocery bill shot up about 30%. Plus, at home, we had to prepare two meals each time. A delicious, fun, appetizing one for my partner, and a vegetarian one for me. Worst of all, I started feeling horrible. Janabai Amsden runs Rawvolution, a vegan restaurant in Santa Monica, California.
Doing things one way for a certain amount of time, let's say 30 or 40 years, and then changing and expecting 10 days to make a difference. It's like putting one fuel in your car and then putting another one and expecting it to run even better. No, there's going to be a time period where the two fuels are mixing. The car's going to smoke, might backfire. It's very confusing. That's what your body's going through.
Well, yeah, I've done a lot of backfiring. I think it's the cabbage, or the spirulina tablets, or the hemp cereal I eat for breakfast. I tell you, you have to be pretty dedicated to make all these changes. In fact, I said so to Dave.
I'd have a very difficult time arguing with you. Very difficult.
This is an interview. Try.
You have to be a stubborn type of a person. I'll take a stand. I don't care if 6 billion people are against me. I'm going to do what's right for me.
Yeah, well, great, but that's you. What about friends and family? You know, people who might not want to eat the filling from padded envelopes. Actually, Colleen thought I was whining way too much.
First of all, you said that, you know, you're making things that nobody else wants to eat. So I think you may need to look at a few more recipes and I can provide you with some. But what
happens...
You're
not selling a book, are you, Colleen, by any
chance? Well, I do have a book. Actually, funny you bring that up.
Yeah, very funny. They're all selling stuff, these guys. Vegetarianism is big business. But if you want to do it too, well, here's my tip. A, phase it in gradually so your body gets used to it. And so does your bank manager. I mean, $16 I paid for a jar of spirulina tablets. 16. Also, B, find a diet that's right for your body. And who do you go to for advice about that?
You should come to me.
Well, that's one option. Dave's website is sunfood.com, but there are tons of other sites too, offering a load of information. Having said all of that, it's been 3 weeks now, and here's the surprise. I feel fantastic. And not in a crazy person way. This stuff works. I only hope it's not too little too late.
So who's going to die first, me or you?
I I hope we both live forever.
So who'll die first, me or you?
I don't know, but I'm going to die happy.
Oh, I can soon put a stop to that. Buckwheat meatloaf, anyone? I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
debone steak, anyone? Change of possession will take on an entirely new meaning at Gillette Stadium this week. The home of the New England Patriots will play host to a foreclosure prevention workshop. The NFL team's charitable foundation is teaming up with the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. Borrowers who face foreclosure will have a chance to tackle the problem head-on by meeting with lenders and counselors. Commentator Dan Dresner has the play-by-play.
It's a lovely day here at Gillette Stadium, and the crowd is really looking forward to this exciting contest between the borrowers and the lenders, sponsored by the Boston Fed. This is not the first meeting between these two, but it's the first in a neutral site. We expect to see a competitive match here today. For years, the borrower's hallmark style has been a mix of Hail Mary passes on offense and an aggressive tackling style on defense. They take out adjustable-rate mortgages and home equity loans with a vengeance, showing no concern for themselves or their future financial health. When pinned to their own goal line, the borrowers always rely on their excellent punting game. They've deferred debt obligations for close to a decade now. It's an imperfect squad, however. Some in the press box say the lenders have been lax in their preparation. A lack of organization and a failure to have all their paperwork in order could hurt their chances in this contest. The borrowers are also understandably nervous about playing in front of a crowd. For many participants, this might be the first time they will have to acknowledge which team they're on. At first glance, the lenders seem to hold all the cards for this match. They have been an unstoppable force for over a decade now. Part of their success on the playing field has come from their willingness to scout global capital markets in search of fresh talent. Every time it seems they're going to come up short, they've been able to inject new resources from abroad. There have also been whispers that the lenders have profited from working the referees to get more favorable calls. Still, some analysts believe that their winning streak is about to come to an end. The lenders have lost a lot of depth as their foreign sources have started to dry up. They could be headed for a big fall. Of course, in this game, it's not really a question of wins and losses. It's whether both sides will be able to continue playing.
Dan Dresner coaches international politics at Tufts University.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
We are back with Getting Personal. Hello again, Chris.
Hello again, Tess.
And let's go ahead and reach into the email bag once more. Elon writes in from Washington, D.C., and he wants to know, we'd like you to get out the Chris Farrell dictionary now.
Okay.
What is market dislocation? He says he hears financial commentators bandying this term about all the time these days, but he can't find a definition anywhere. So give us your best shot at this.
Okay, this is when Tess calls me on the phone and says, what is going on?
Which
what
I do all the time.
There's a couple of different definitions. A sort of more technical definition is a 10% move in the market in a single week.
That's pretty big. 10% in a single week?
It's a big move, and it changes the way we're looking at the markets. I think Bear Stearns and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, those were market dislocations because we don't look at the world the same way that we did a week ago.
All right. If you don't know a money term, we will try to give you a definition from the Chris Farrell Dictionary. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right. Let's go to the phones again. Our next caller is James, and he's with us from Irvine, California. Hi, James.
Hi.
I understand congratulations are in order.
Yes. I just had a baby.
Yay. Well, and everybody's happy and healthy?
Yes. Yes.
Terrific. Well, does your question have anything to do with this?
Well, my wife has decided to stay home for the rest of the year, and we have a big amount of mortgage to refinance. Right now, our current rate is at 5%, and it has another 2 years. So the question is, should I refinance now, or should I wait another 2 years? This is the money I can save for college fund or the future.
So you have an adjustable rate mortgage that will adjust in 2 years?
Yes.
How big is your mortgage?
650.
650, and you have currently at 5%. Chris, that's a pretty good rate.
It's a very good rate.
So I guess my first question would be, would he even be able to refinance? I mean, we've been talking on the show quite a bit about the fact that banks are not doing a whole lot of refinancing, handing out money at all.
It's more difficult these days, but if you have a good credit score and you do have some equity in the home, you probably can refinance, or at least it's worth a try. So I have a couple of reactions just to go through. So it's important to you and your wife that she not work for a year with your new baby.
Yes.
Okay, so that's a value. So then the question is, how can we make that happen? What are the risks? So one thing to do is to be really clear-eyed and understand what are the risks in terms of your mortgage. If you don't refinance and you wait the 2 years, what's the worst case scenario? If you don't understand, you have any questions, you know, go to a banker, have someone run it for you. So you really understand if interest rates really skyrocket, the world goes bad, and you get the maximum reset, you know, what's going to be the hit? How bad will that be for you? And will you be able to absorb it? Second piece of information, I think, is a sense of priorities. You know, so the priority is your wife's not going to work. So therefore, I wouldn't save for a child's college education. It's nice that you want to do that, but I wouldn't save for the child's college education. I'd be using this time to build up my savings in case you do end up with the worst case scenario and you get with a high reset, that you're not vulnerable financially, that you have created a situation that you are reasonably safe because you've used this time to build up your savings in case the world goes against you. The final piece of information is, if it turns out the reset is just too dangerous financially for you, it's just too much risk, it's too much cost, then you would go ahead and do the refinancing.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
All right, thanks for the call.
Great. Thank you very much for your help.
Take care, James.
Take care. Bye.
You know, Tess, I really wish I could predict interest rates 2 years from now.
Yeah, that would be good for both of us, wouldn't it?
It really would be. And, you know, if I knew where interest rates were going to be, then I could say refinance or don't refinance. But I don't.
Well, if you do end up somehow developing that talent, do let me know and you and I can make a lot of money. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Visit our website at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. And, of course, you can always call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So do the airlines not want customers? Because they seem to be doing everything in their power to tee us off. This week, JetBlue added pillows and blankets to the list of extras you'll have to pay for. And according to a government study, fully one quarter of all flights were late in the first half of this year. But even worse than leaving or arriving late is not getting to leave or arrive at all. It goes something like this. I'm afraid this flight's been overbooked and I don't have a seat for you. Sorry? So what can you do? I bet Scott McCartney knows. He writes the middle seat column for The Wall Street Journal, and thanks for sitting with us.
Good to be with you.
Can you still get compensated if a flight is overbooked and you're involuntarily bumped?
Yes, you can. In fact, the government recently doubled the amount that the airline has to pay to you for a penalty for bumping you from a flight involuntarily, up to as much as $800 now, which I think is a more appropriate level. It level hadn't been changed in 30 years. It was only $400, and there was too much incentive for an airline to bump somebody, pay a $400 penalty, and put somebody on the airplane who'd pay $1,000 for a seat.
Can you explain to us quickly why airlines have this business model where they do so much overbooking?
You know, it's really unique in business, and they did get permission years ago from the government to do this. But the theory is that some people don't show up for flights. And so the airline, facing a real problem, that they can't inventory their product. Once the door closes, that seat is gone. And in that case, the government allows airlines to overbook so that they don't end up with empty seats.
There are some people who actively look to get bumped because they want these free tickets or vouchers, what have you. I've done it myself. In fact, I'm sitting on, I think, $1,200 worth of Delta dollars because I got bumped a few months ago. Is this a good idea?
Well, it can be. You have to sort of know the rules and you have to know how to game the system. You're right. There are people that try very hard to get bumped. They book crowded flights on Friday evenings, knowing that the airline's likely to start asking for volunteers. And then there's the game of when do you volunteer? The airline starts low, maybe offering $200 to people to give up their seats. And if nobody comes forward, they go higher. So a couple cautions. One is that those vouchers often come with restrictions. They can be difficult to redeem. They may only apply to certain fare categories. Some airlines are better at allowing you to use them electronically, and others require you to do it over the phone or in person even.
In which case, they'll probably charge you.
Right. So you need the assistance of one of their agents, and that's a $20 or $30
right.
charge. You have to be tricky on that end. And I think the other thing you have to watch out for these days is because flights have been so full, it may be some time before there's an empty seat to get you where you want to go. Or if you're just going to be on the standby list, it could be 2 days before you get an empty seat. You may have walked into something far worse than you bargained for.
Well, aside from a voucher, is there anything else you can negotiate for when you are bumped?
Not if you voluntarily give up your seat, but if you are involuntarily bumped, the airline, by law, has to pay you cash. Now, most airlines don't want to do that and may not offer you cash, but understanding your rights, you can demand cash from the airline. If the airline can get you to where you're going within 2 hours of your original schedule, the penalty is the value of your one-way ticket up to $400. And if it's more than 2 hours, which in most cases it would be, it's up to $800 maximum.
What about, say, if you requested to be upgraded on that next flight that they're able to get you out on? Maybe try for first class?
You can certainly try. That's basically up to the airline. It's going to depend on how good a customer you are, what your fare was, things like that. These days, airlines are really hesitant to give out upgrades. They're trying to sell first-class seats. They're trying to sell upgrades to people. So that may be more difficult to land than it used to be, but certainly worth a try.
Scott McCartney writes the middle seat column for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining us again today.
Always good to be with you, Tess.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the struggle to return to the Big Easy 3 years after Katrina.
The middle-income folks have definitely felt the pinch from trying to come back. The folks who've been able to come back the fastest were the people who had their own resources, not only just insurance, but money in the bank.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.